Remy, Pepe, and Sam crossed the plaza, going around the Palacio and continuing north on foot. The new town lay north of and apart from the plaza. It was centered around that great architectural and cultural folly, the Opera House. Built by Don Carlos's immediate predecessor and the cause of his ruination, the Opera House was a grandiose Baroque pile topped by a domed roof and four-corner turrets, surrounded by gardens bordered by iron spear fences and gates. A wealthy residential section had grown up in the neighborhood, attractive, expensive houses bordered by high walls. Most of its denizens were newly rich, owing their affluence to the slave trade brokered by Don Carlos. A cobblestone road led through the main gates of the Opera House, making a looping drive that curved through the gardens to the foot of the marble stairs, then back out again.
It was made so that the opera patrons could arrive by carriage to the performances. Never used, of course. No opera has ever been staged at La Casa. No touring company in the world would come to Pago for fear that their prima donna sopranos and coloraturas would be stolen away and locked in a gilded cage like the veriest songbird.
The main gates were open. Inside the gateway, on the left, stood a guard box. The guards were two of Don Carlos's vaqueros, his riders. They looked more like pistoleros than cattle tenders of the ranchero. They were armed with repeating rifles and gun belts.
Good morning, men.
Both nodded in acknowledgement. Herrera swept through the gates without slowing, and Sam and Remy kept right up with him.
And that was easy.
It gets harder at the Opera House entrance. That is the real test.
The grounds had once been handsomely landscaped with lawns, box hedges, flower beds, straight and winding paths. They were pieces of marble statuary, nooks with stone alcoves and small circular ponds. All were long neglected now. The grass needed cutting, for it was ankle high. Weeds grew in the cracks between paving stones on the garden paths. The hedges needed trimming. The ponds were empty, dried up. The Opera House loomed ahead.
That's one of the damnedest things I've ever seen. And to find it here in Pago, of all places.
Looked like a beached whale. Beach marble whale that washed up in the Espinosa.
We call it La Casa de las Lloronas.
The House of Crying Women.
Yes, that is how we name it. In private, behind locked doors and shuttered windows. To be free of the spies of Don Carlos and Capitan Bravo.
That bad, huh? Are the spies so many?
Who can say? They don't wear signs. That is part of the problem. Trust. Who to trust? Is the man sitting at the next table in the cantina working as the eyes and ears of Don Carlos? That neighbor across the fence? The woman in the next church pew? The old lady peeking out from behind the curtains? Is she a harmless village busybody or one of Don Carlos's spies? It's hard to tell. How can you be sure? Yet to pass a word in the wrong ear, in the wrong place, at the wrong time, can mean death for the unlucky. Not the unwary, for all are on their guard, but the unlucky, for blind chance so often decides who shall live and who shall die.
How do you know you can trust us?
How do you know you can trust me? Perhaps even now I am the Judas goat leading you to the slaughterhouse, senores.
How indeed.
Put your minds at ease, gentlemen. I am no traitor.
Sam wasn't worried, not about Herrera betraying them. He prided himself on his ability to read people, and all his instincts told him that Herrera was all right. And if by some fluke he were not all right, he would be the first to die. Sam would see to that.
Don Carlos's men killed my brother when he was protesting the slave raids on the Campesinos. He shot him down like a dog. Don Carlos thinks I don't know the truth, and I never let on that I do. That is how I've managed to worm my way into his confidence. So now I am placed at the black heart of the slave master's operation, ready to strike. I laugh at their jokes, grovel for their filthy money, and look the other way among their numberless infamies. All the time I am waiting. Waiting for the day that I cast aside the mask and take my vengeance. The day when I become the worm that gnaws at the heart. The worm that kills.
With any luck, that day is about to dawn. Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown. The head of Don Carlos.
May it be so, my friends. In any case, you come well recommended. You could not hope for a better sponsor than the Chacon.
Being a bandit and a cutthroat, his references are impeccable, huh?
In Pago, yes. Ila Chacon is the one man those of us who hate Don Carlos and his works can be sure of. The Chacon will never turn his coat and become one of Don Carlos's creatures. There is no reconciling those two. Theirs is a peculiarly pure mutual hatred. They are locked in a blood feud which can only end with the death of one or the other, or both.
Why do they have a big hate on for each other?
Gila is a campesino, a peasant. He comes from a long line of peasants bound to the Vega Estancia, the estate. I speak now of the original Vega bloodline, the real one, not the newcomer who bought the title. The last of the De La Vegas went bankrupt after building the opera house. He died shortly after of taking poison, whether by his own hand or another's, who can say? He lived long enough to sell his lands and title to Carlos Mondragon, going so far as to adopt him, to ensure that the title and patent of nobility were passed directly to him. Old Vega was then so considerate as to conveniently die, permitting Mondragon to become the newly ennobled Don Carlos. When he made himself master of the Estancia, Don Carlos began by showing the peasants that his was a new regime. He did this with violence, brutality, lavishly dispensed by his private army of pistoleros and thugs. Where his predecessor ground the peons fine, he ground them to dust. Many died by the shootings and beatings and torture, more by starvation. The males of the Chacon family butchered a Vega cow to avoid perishing for want of food. They took what meat they needed and gave the rest to their relatives and neighbors. To make an object lesson of them, Don Carlos killed all the male Chacons, from the oldest graybeard to the youngest babe in arms. The father and his two oldest sons, Don Carlos, hanged, leaving them hanging until the flesh dropped from their bones. By sheer luck, young Gila was away from home when the vaqueros came for the others, so he escaped. Don Carlos put a price on his head and a sentence of death on any who might aid the boy with food or shelter. But Gila did not die. Somehow he escaped to run away and survive. He became an outlaw, a bandit. As soon as he was able, he began bedeviling Don Carlos, stealing his horses, rustling his cattle, shooting down his vaqueros wherever he could find them. The last of his line, and now the first when it came to deeds of blood and valor. Gila was acclaimed as the Chacon. Neither Don Carlos nor Capitan Bravo, then Teniente Bravo, Lieutenant Bravo, you would call him, could catch him. He made fools of both of them. The clamor reached Mexico City, where Bravo's superior officers became displeased. They put a black mark beside his name in the official records, ensuring that Bravo would never rise higher than the rank of Capitan and never command a post more prestigious than the Pago Presidio. This went on for some time. Then came the old, old story. The Chacon's woman was Carmen Oliva, a fiery beauty with a body made by Satan to lead the race of Adam astray. She was a faithless slut, a born whore, as much of a born whore as her vicious half-brother Dorado was a born killer. Carmen could be had by anyone for a few pesos or a cheap trinket. It was common knowledge, known to all except the bandito. Or if he knew, he was so besotted with her charms that he chose to ignore the truth. Carmen was not only his woman, she was his wife, married to him by a priest in a church. You can guess the rest. Carmen decided she was the Chacon's woman no more. She took up with Capitan Bravo first, but quickly moved on to better prospects. Don Carlos himself. She needed little urging to betray the outlaw for gold, baiting him into a death trap sprung by soldiers and the vaqueros. Yet somehow the Chacon managed to break free, though not before being seriously wounded. That was some years ago. Since then, the Chacon has long since recovered from his wounds and resumed his career of banditry with a new gang somewhere a long way from here, though he sneaks into Pago from time to time to work some devilment on his old foe. No, he and Don Carlos will never rest until death writes El Fin to the blood feud. Many of us hate Don Carlos and will not rest until he is destroyed. But we don't want to throw away our lives needlessly. Too many martyrs have already died in desperate ploys, with little or no chance of success. Now it remains to be seen what you can do, senores. Show us how to do the deed in a way that will win, and you will find us ready and willing to do what we can to help. Aye, even at the cost of our lives. For be sure that there is no way you can throw down the challenge to Don Carlos without putting your own lives at risk.
As indeed you do now. But now we are here at La Casa. Best we speak of other things. You must be the rich, carefree whoremonger and his hired gun, while I embrace my role of grinning, fawning toady to a gang of pimps and killers.
That puts a different slant on Gila, huh?
Well-dressed folks strolled about the grounds and gardens, taking their ease. They were obviously buyers in town for the slave auction. Most were men, but there were some women, whorehouse madams and procuresses. All were well-fed, proudly flaunting the accoutrements of prosperity, having achieved the good life by doing bad. Some bared their evil nature openly stamped on face and form, with animalistic visages and twisted bodies. Others were handsome and attractive, beautiful and alluring. Some looked and dressed like respectable businessmen, others like racetrack touts. Pimps and vice merchants from the cities of the interior and the coasts often were dressed loudly, flashily, with showy hats, flamboyant cravats, and brocaded vests, thick gold chains, and diamond pinky rings. The bodyguards almost always could be seen for what they were, gunmen, pistoleros. They stayed close to their paymasters, but not too close. Some wore weapons openly in holstered gun belts. Others concealed theirs under jackets and inside hip pockets where they made obvious bulges. Noting their behavior, Sam faded back a pace or two, trailing Remy from behind and to the side. He, Remy, and Herrera crossed the curved drive fronting the structure. A brick apron led to a wide, curving marble staircase. Long, shallow steps were arranged in tiers separated by wide landings. The trio climbed the stairs to the portico, passing between Corinthian columns decorated with elaborate stonework. They went under an overhanging pediment roof, out of the sunlight, into the shadow. Several small knots of people stood scattered among the pillars, putting their heads together, talking among themselves. Some of the women gave Sam and Remy frankly appraising looks, liking what they saw. The pistoleros saw that the newcomers wore their guns openly and carried themselves as if they knew how to use them and wouldn't shy from doing so if challenged. A central set of big brass double doors was propped open. Sam, Remy, and Herrera passed beneath an arched entryway into a high-ceilinged vaulting lobby and entrance hall, the checkerboard marble floor echoing to their footfalls. It was cooler indoors, out of the sun. A few paces beyond the entrance and to one side of it stood a uniformed doorman and two armed guards. Herrera held a hand up in greeting, and the other nodded coolly in return.
Pepe?
The doorman looked questioningly at the two strangers.
Buyers.
The doorman waved Remy and Sam through. The three started across the main floor, Herrera leading a pace ahead, angling now to the left.
Hold up there! One moment, gentlemen, if you please.
A clerkish-looking fellow charged up to the trio. He was short, thin, with an oversized head sprouting a thatch of unruly black hair and a bristling black beard. A pair of wire-rimmed spectacles with thumbprint-sized green-tinted lenses perched on the middle of a wide-bridged nose. The armed guards posted near the entrance tensed. They were blank-faced, but paying close attention, ready to take their cue from the clerk.
Sebastiano, Don Carlos's man, and nobody's fool.
Would you gentlemen please step over to the side?
What's all this?
Please.
Sebastiano gestured in the direction in which he wanted them to go. The two armed guards came up behind Sam and Remy, who had to proceed as Sebastiano indicated or risk the guards colliding into them. The two fell into step, good-humored, easy. When they were sufficiently isolated from the others in the lobby, Sebastiano circled around so that he was facing them. He had small, neat hands. He held them clasped in front of his belt buckle. The guards stood behind the duo.
This is your first time at the exhibition. I crave the privilege of making your acquaintance and examining your credentials. Entrance to these premises is restricted to members of the trade.
Credentials? I'm sorry, I didn't bring any of my sporting fillies with me to Pago That seemed like carrying coals to Newcastle, huh? This trip I buy, not sell.
Credentials!
I found these two strays wandering about the Zocolo trying to find the opera house, Sebastiano, so I brought them here. I'm hoping to earn myself a finder's fee for steering these gentlemen to the merchandise.
Looks like you got competition.
Our custom is reserved to members of the trade, specialized clientele. We reserve the right to refuse admittance.
Kind of exclusive, ain't you, amigo?
Now, Cherokee, there's no need for impertinence. The gentleman's only doing his job. Yes, we know of the Enterprise in Pago, even in the quaint little backwater from which I hail, a charmingly insignificant and unimportant provincial hamlet, Nawlins. Perhaps you heard of it?
You are a long way from Los Estados Unidos, senor.
Quite, and I hope it doesn't prove to be a wasted trip.
We shall see. We shall see. You are...
Monsieur Jules Duval, owner and proprietor of the House of the Rising Sun in the Quartier Latin. French Quarter to you.
I know what the Quartier Latin is, sir.
Well, then you know that the Rising Sun is one of the most expensive and exclusive pleasure palaces on the Gulf Coast, monsieur. My customers demand the best and are willing to pay for it. So am I. As you must know, there's a fast turnover in the trade. The patrons are always looking for some new. And what's newer and more precious in this wicked old world but innocence? Tender young flesh, you know. Unspoiled, new. For that, I'll pay top dollar, provided it lives up to advance billing and is as advertised.
And the exhibition promises satisfaction guaranteed. We require the same of our clients. That they be what they seem to be.
I could provide a dozen references for my colleagues in New Orleans. They'd be glad to vouch for me, but be sure to exercise discretion in wording your telegram inquiries, please.
The nearest telegraph lines are in Mexico City. Perhaps one of the other buyers could vouch for you.
This is my first visit. The reason I'm down here is because I'm looking to develop new markets.
Are there not young girls enough in your homeland to satisfy your needs?
Virgins in New Orleans? Don't be ridiculous. After all, we can't just grab them off the street and carry them away like you do here.
There is a little more to it than that, sir.
Now, don't get me wrong. I don't speak ill of it. Quite the contrary. I admire what you've done here.
Reaching into his jacket's inside pocket, Remy took out his money pouch, loosening the drawstrings and opening its mouth. He poured a quantity of gold coins into an open palm, the glittering golden discs jingling with their cheery music.
I dare say my money is as good as any man's here.
Sebastiano eyed the coins, little golden glints mirrored in the dark of his eyes.
Your credentials are impeccable, monsieur. Welcome to the Pago exhibition.
Delighted.
Remy discreetly pressed several gold coins into Sebastiano's hand.
That's not necessary, sir. But thank you.
Sebastiano pocketed the money.
A bit risky traveling about Mexico with such a large sum.
What is pocket change? My real assets are being held in reserve for the auction. As for the danger, I can take care of myself. My associate, Cherokee, also protects my interests.
Ah, very good, monsieur. A pleasure to make your acquaintance.
He nodded to the two guards, making shooing motions with his fingers as if brushing away insect pests. They withdrew, returning to their posts inside the front entrance.
The livestock will be available for viewing until sundown tonight and all day tomorrow. The auction begins tomorrow night promptly at 8 o'clock. And we do mean promptly at 8. In a moment, Pepe will show you what you want to see and answer any questions you may have. Pepe, a brief word, please.
He took Pepe to one side, several paces away, out of earshot of Remy and Sam, for an exchange of hurried, whispered conversation. Sebastiano did most of the talking, Herrera nodding in agreement.
Good luck in tomorrow night's bidding, monsieur. May you find whatever it is you seek.
Mm-hmm. That is my fondest wish.
Sebastiano went away, off on some private errand.
What did he want?
He demanded a cut of whatever you might pay me as a bonus. Naturally, I agreed. Though he did not offer to share any of what you gave him, nor did I ask him to. You see, we understand each other very well, Sebastiano and I.
Herrera started off once again, Sam and Remy following. They crossed to a door on the far left. It opened onto the landing of a stairwell. A flight of stairs went up to a balcony, and another flight descended to an underground level. They went downstairs through an open doorway at the bottom of the well into a long corridor that ran the length of the building. They traveled its length, emerging in the understage area, a maze of storerooms and side rooms at the rear of the theater. The side rooms were the so-called green rooms, originally intended for use of the members of opera troupes before, during, and after performances. No opera singer had ever graced the premises. Here was where the captive females were now kept, held separated by groups in different rooms. Apparently, the slavers found it easier that way to maintain control of both their human chattel and the prospective buyers examining them. There was a gamey odor of flesh and soap, the smell of the sweat of fear gone cold on taut young bodies, stiff and angular with terror, mixed with a sharp chemical reek of ammonia and disinfectant. The rooms were guarded on the outside by armed gunmen, and on the inside by female enforcers, adult women in the trade, prison matron types mostly, strong, solid, and unforgiving. Remy and Sam made a point of visiting all the rooms in which girls were kept. They wanted to avoid betraying undue interest in the abducted American girls for fear of exciting suspicion in their keepers. The mazy warren of rooms penned dozens, scores of girls, numbering in all somewhere between 50 and 60. Most were Mexican, their ages ranging from full-grown young adult women through the middle teens and down to the barely pubescent. Many were very young. Their clothes had been taken from them, and they'd all been uniformly outfitted in simple white shifts, sleeveless cotton nightdresses that hugged their ripening curves. An atmosphere of misery, shock, and stunned resignation predominated among the captives, who wished for nothing more than to be anywhere else. They could look forward only to being sold on the block and condemned to a life of whoredom. Pepe Herrera kept a line of patter, flip, brittle, and intended to be amusing, or at least sound that way to anyone eavesdropping on him and his two companions. He was used to playing a part, putting on the mask every day to go among these he hated and wanted dead, pretending they were a fine bunch of co-workers and associates. Remy and Sam went from room to room, eyeing the merchandise. Other buyers and groups of buyers were doing the same, weighing and judging which specimens they wanted the most and for whom they would pay the highest price. It reminded Sam of nothing so much as a horse auction. He actually saw a number of canny buyers holding the jaws of young girls open to appraise the condition of their teeth. It was a mighty grim business, made endurable only by the knowledge that he was working an agenda of his own, a hidden agenda that with luck would give slavers and buyers alike a big surprise. The course of their inspection tour brought Sam and Remy to where the American girls were penned. Seven from the wagon train and five others who'd been picked up along the way, 12 in all. Sam knew the Bearpaw girls by Linda Gordon's description of their names, ages, and personal characteristics, a list he'd committed to memory. Devin Collins, 14. Her sister, April Collins, 10. The Haber sisters, Eva, 16, and Gretchen, 12. Jenna Rowley, 17. Mandy Sutton, 13. And Priscilla Ard. He didn't know the names of the other five, and it would have broken character in his role of bodyguard to a New Orleans whoremonger to inquire, but memory of the girls' lost, haunted faces was branded into his brain. They seemed to be in decent enough health, intact and relatively unharmed, at least physically, so far, that is. They were policed by Duena Dulce, a fearsome female bulldog quick to lash out with a leather strap at her charges for various real or imagined minor transgressions of attitude and deportment. The captives huddled together in shared misery, some seeming to try to shrink in on themselves to avoid drawing the attention of oily buyers with icy eyes, lewd comments, and probing fingers. Eyes were red from crying. Faces looked prematurely aged, haggard with strain. Sobs and whimpers drew menacing glares from Duenna Dulce and the imminent threat of harsh correction. The girls were terrified of her. Due to the rarity in these parts of the trophy animals, the American girls drew much interest, even by those disinclined to buy because of high prices. Many wanted to have a look to satisfy their curiosity, their numbers requiring a traffic manager and waiting line. Inspection done, Remy and Sam moved on to the next room to continue counterfeiting interest in the goods. Remy had the harder part as the buyer. He had to take more of an active interest, playing out his role with vigor so no false note would be detected by Don Carlos's and Sebastiano's spies and eyes. Sam, as bodyguard, had an easier role to play, seeming to show his primary interest as that of protecting his principal. Sam spent much time in a level-eyed survey of room guards and the buyer's personal gunman, happy to see no one there that he knew or that knew him. Gunmen are used to giving each other bad eyes, that "I'm your pallbearer" stare. It comes with the territory. The pistoleros coldly and unsympathetically sized each other up for future reference. Sam and Remy took note of the floor layout, the twistings and turnings of halls and corridors, the location of the rooms where girls were held, all the girls, the number and placement of the guards, how well armed they were, where positioned, at which critical junctions, the location of entrances, exits, and stairwells. Herrera led them through a doorway into a big room filled with machinery and rigged with rope lines like a sailing ship.
The understage area.
The space was unguarded, empty of buyers. The vice merchants wanted flesh, not man-powered machines. Sam looked around with interest. The gear included block-and-tackle hoists, lifts, winches, capstans, and similar devices for getting performers, props, and sets on stage and off stage fast.
The gear looks well-tended.
It's kept in fine working order. The Opera House was equipped with everything needed to stage a full-fledged performance. The lifting machinery was shipped to the port of Veracruz, transported to Mexico City, and then hauled overland by freight wagon to Pago. The pity of it is that it's never been used for what it's intended. No opera has ever gone up on this stage, but it serves a purpose, in a way. At auction time, the separate lots of girls, lot being a term of art in the auction game to describe the property going up on the block for bids, the different lots of girls are loaded onto that stage elevator and lifted up onto the stage through those overhead trap doors. It's designed to move big stage props and backdrops on stage fast. It makes for a spectacular effect. One moment, the stage is bare of all save the auctioneer. The next, a group of young lovelies comes up through the bottom of the floor, as if by magic. It always gets a great reaction from the buyers. The buyers love it.
That lifting platform really works then.
Yes, the rope hawsers on the lift run through a series of block and tackle winches rigged to a capstan. It's modeled on the same principle that lets a handful of sailors raise and lower a heavy anchor and chain. A few stagehands turning the capstan wheel can effortlessly raise and lower the platform.
Those doors at the back, do they open?
Sam indicated a pair of solid metal double doors set in the rear wall.
Yes, they're locked now, locked from the inside. One of Sebastiano's creatures has the keys. The doors open on ground level. They're used to move the girls in and out of the building quickly, and to bring in food and supplies.
Now, I detect the beginning of a plan germinating in your head.
I've got a few ideas. They're still in the budding stage.
Twin sets of spiral staircases stood at the left and right of the understage area. Sam went to one, looking up to where the staircase went through a hole in the ceiling to the stage above.
Those give the crew a quick access to the stage and understage areas.
Can we go on stage?
Now? Yes, it is permitted. Outsiders are banned from the stage and understage during the auction, however.
Let's go up.
They climbed the spiral staircase, Herrera first, then Remy and Sam. The staircase topped off on stage in a wing of the backstage area. The layout was a proscenium arch stage with a semicircular wooden apron extending beyond the frame of the arch towards where the audience would be seated. The rows of seats were now currently unoccupied, of course. The Pago Opera House was minor and inconsequential compared to the grand concert halls of Europe and New York. It was a vest pocket edition, a modest jewel box of a theater. What was amazing about it was the fact that it had been built at all here in Pago, amidst the ragged mountains and high desert plains of the Espinazo. Exit doors were ranged along the long side walls of the theater. At the opposite end, above the orchestra seats, was a balcony.
That completes the tour.
I think we've seen enough.
Remy nodded his agreement.
I hope the tour has been inspirational.
I've got a few ideas in my play. I'll develop them later.
I will escort you to the exit.
We should meet tonight to make our plans.
We'll be staying in town overnight. Too risky to keep running back and forth to the hideout outside of Pago. It might draw suspicion.
Try the Lamplighter Hotel. It's cheap and clean. The owner is not one of us, so it will lull Don Carlos' spies if you are where they can keep an eye on you.
We give it a go.
They made a show of parting. Remy reached for the gold, taking some coins from the pouch.
Not too much. Sebastiano will take most of it. But not too little, either. I don't want him to think you're cheap.
Thanks for looking out for our good name.
Remy handed Pepe the coins.
Gracias. Any thoughts as to how to make the fatal strike?
Not indefinite yet.
I've got a few ideas I'm kicking around. I see some promising angles of approach. If they work, they just might bring down the house.
Good, good.
I'll let you know more later, after I've studied on the subject for a while.
I look forward to it. To act, to strike. After all these years of being ground under the heel of Don Carlos, I must leave you now. I'm sure you can find your way back to the Zocalo. I must give Sebastiano his share of the gold, lest he accuse me of hiding some for myself. This way I can turn out my pockets to prove that I hold back nothing, and that I am an honest crook, at least where he is concerned.
Herrera turned, going back inside. No sooner had he passed through the front doors than Sebastiano swooped down on him with open palm and grasping claw. Herrera gave a sickly smile as he dug into his pants pocket and hauled out the payoff for appropriation. Sam and Remy made their way across the grounds toward the front gate.
That was hell, pretending to be a flesh peddler, not giving any of the girls an encouraging word that help us on the way.
We've got to keep playing our parts until the final curtain.
But whatever else we do, those girls have got to be freed. Not just the one from our side of the border, all of them.
That's my thinking, too.
The others may not get far if they're loosed, but at least they have a chance to escape.
If we do our job right, there won't be many slavers left to bother them after the show.
It was opening night, Saturday. The Pago slave auction was about to begin in a half hour, promptly on the dot of 8 o'clock. A crowd of opera buff swells in black tie formal wear and evening gowns would have been hard put to outdo the enthusiasm and anticipation displayed by the pack of vice lords and ladies, not to mention their bodyguards and hangers-on, as they came down the aisles to take their places in the prime center orchestra seats of the theater. Buyers and bidders, whoremongers and madams, pimps and procuresses eagerly awaited the opening of the curtains for the unveiling of all that fresh young female flesh destined for the auction block. Any moment now, the red velvet curtains stretched across the proscenium arch screening the stage would part to reveal the first lot of nubile captive girls. Close to 150 favored customers and their entourages filled plush, maroon velvet cushioned seats facing the stage. Conspicuous by his absence was the supreme slave master himself, Don Carlos. The padrón felt it was incumbent on his dignity as a titled aristocrat and landowner to maintain a certain distance from the enterprise which had brought him wealth, power, and an official patent of nobility. He was safely and comfortably ensconced at home at his rancho outside town, secure in the knowledge that his punctilious overseer Sebastiano would ensure that the proceedings went aright. Don Carlos's pistoleros served as armed guards posted along the theater's side and rear walls. Riflemen kept watch in the balcony. The hall buzzed with high spirits, yet nowhere among the assembled were New Orleans vice merchant Jules Deval nor his bodyguard Cherokee to be found. Sam and Remy were in the house, if not the audience. Decked out in stuffy formal wear rented that afternoon from a Pago tailor, they had entered the opera house with the other guests when the entrance doors were first opened to receive them. But now, they were back in the understage area, but in a small storeroom. Despite the formal wear, Sam and Remy were well armed. Sam had a pistol stuck in the top of his waistband at his right hip, worn butt out. His sheath knife hung below his left arm. Gun and knife were covered by his jacket, which he'd gotten in a too large size to help conceal the telltale bulge of weaponry. Remy, too, had a pistol stuck in his belt, along with the sleeve gun hidden in his right cuff and a derringer in his left jacket pocket. There were no lights in the storeroom. Sam and Remy waited in the darkness, broken only by the wan glow of lights shining through the crack under the door and a slitted vertical crack where the door stood slightly ajar from its frame, open a half inch. Remy pressed his face to the crack, peering through it, keeping watch on the comings and goings in the corridor. Sam kept watch, too, less with his eyes than with his ears. Remy checked his pocket watch by the sliver of soft light shining through the crack of the open door.
7:40. Or every 10 minutes late, this auction starts at 8 o'clock.
Someone's coming.
Oh, here.
Sorry. Sebastiano was making a bother of himself under stage with last-minute preparations, making sure that everything would be just so. The sharp-eyed little wretch. I had to wait until he went on stage upstairs.
Anyone keeping an eye on him?
Pablo, one of the stage crew. He's one of us. We lost precious time. Now we must hurry. 8 o'clock draws nigh.
Sam and Remy stepped into the corridor. Herrera set off toward the rear of the building, the duo following. They walked side by side, shoulder to shoulder, traversing the passage to the understage area at its far end. The still air was thick with the rank smell of too much flesh and too much fear. As they neared the end of the passageway, two men rounded the corner, stepping into view. They stopped short when they saw Herrera approaching with Sam and Remy in tow.
Keep going.
Sam took a cigar from his inside breast pocket, biting off the tip and spitting it out, all seeming nonchalance. He ignited a lucifer match, striking it into flame with his thumbnail. He lit up, puffing hard, venting smoke, cigar tip, a bright orange disc. The smoke was good, masking the sickly, overbearing, fleshy smell. The guards moved to bar the way.
You must go upstairs, senores. No guest allowed down here now. It is prohibited. The auction is about to start.
These gentlemen are friends of Sebastiano. Very generous gentlemen. They want one last look at some of the girls, to be sure their money will be well spent. They have plenty of gold to spread around.
The understage is closed, senores. You must go to...
Sam thrust the lit end of his cigar into the stocky man's eye. Remy drew the gun from under his jacket, slashing its short, stubby barrel across the guard's face. The guard recovered quickly and his hand shot out, closing on the wrist of Remy's gun hand. They locked up, struggling for control of the gun. Sam pulled the knife from under his arm. He cut the first guard's throat with a stroke that came close to decapitating him. He sidestepped, thrusting the knife into the other guard's chest through his heart.
Caramba! The fat's in the fire now!
Sam wiped the knife blade clean on the guard's pants leg, returning it to its sheath. Herrera peeked around the corner.
Any more?
All clear for now.
Remy risked a quick glance at his pocket watch.
Less than 10 minutes to your cutting time.
Sam stuck the pistol in the top of his pants, covering it with the black jacket. Remy tucked away his gun in likewise style. They made a right turn at the corner, entering a cross passage that met the long corridor at right angles. Herrera squared his shoulders, assuming an air of jauntiness and forcing a cocky grin, once more the feisty bantamweight. Sam glanced at his front, splattered with ruby teardrops, blood droplets that had sprayed him when he made his kills. Well, there was nothing for it but to keep on making his play. His dark eyes glittered intently. His face was a mask of stolidity. Along the cross corridor they went, into the understage area and its maze of rooms where the captive girls were penned. Three men loomed ahead, burly stagehands in denim overalls, six guns in hand.
Our men.
He, Sam, and Remy joined the others. They exchanged knowing nods and tight grins.
What of the other crew members, the Sebastiano's people?
In there.
One of the stagehands indicated the door accessing a big barn-like room directly beneath the stage.
They had an accident. They fell down and broke their necks.
His companion's smiles widened.
Sebastiano?
Up in the theater. Pablo will warn us if he starts to come downstairs.
Herrera nodded and turned to Sam and Remy.
We had best secure the girls now.
Are the back doors open?
No, but I have the keys.
The stagehand pulled a key ring from a hip pocket, holding them up for the others to see.
I took it off of one of Sebastiano's loyalists after I killed him.
Open the door.
Hands up!
Duena Dulce, the matron assigned to guard the Arizona girls, stepped out of the green room with gun in hand, pointing it at the conspirators gathered in the hall outside the understage door. A big caliber horse pistol was held level at her ample hip.
Oh, what treachery is this? I knew something was afoot.
She moved forward.
I'll kill the first one that moves.
She'll do it too. Easy, men, easy.
Sam raised his hands along with the others, his right hand stealing to the back of his neck to reach for the throwing knife held on a rawhide cord down between his shoulder blades. An old woman slipped out of the green room where the American girls were being kept, coming up behind Duena Dulce. The old one had long silvery hair tied in a knot at the back of her head, a wrinkled bird-like face, and weighed less than 100 pounds. A withered, claw-like hand clutched a club-like lead weight of the type used to secure the rigging, raising it to strike.
Don Carlos will have you flayed alive, traitors!
Easy!
The old one brought the weight down suddenly, savagely, on the back of Duena Dulce's head. Duena Dulce's black button eyes rolled up in her head, only the white showing. The old one was poised to strike again, but it was unneeded. Pepe Herrera bent over the body and pried the gun from her ham-like fist.
That did for her. She's dead.
La vieja, the old woman, a cleaning woman, and one of ours. Her granddaughters were taken and sold on the block.
Best secure the rest of the women guards now.
Give me the gun. I know what to do with it.
Herrera handed her the pistol. She handled it lovingly, slitted eyes undimmed with age, alight with malice and eager expectation.
Someone's knocking at the back door.
Vicente, Miguel, come with me. We'll take care of the women guards. Hector, unlock the door and see who it is. I pray it is our friends who are knocking.
Pepe glanced at Sam and Remy.
You had better go with them.
Hector ducked through the doorway into the understage area, Sam and Remy following. Crossing the threshold of the understage area, Sam glimpsed from the corner of his eye four corpses heaped in an untidy pile against the wall to the left of the entrance. The bodies of the freshly slain loyalist stagehands.
Let's not take any chances.
Sam raised his gun and flattened his back against the wall to one side of the double doors. Remy did the same, taking up a similar stance on the other side of the doors, so that he and Sam flanked them.
3, 2, 1. That's the recognition code. Let them in.
Hector fitted a key from the ring into the doors, unlocking them. He opened one door. Outside, five men stood grouped around a wheeled serving cart, three outfitted as guards and two in white jackets and servants' livery. The guards wore broad-brimmed sombreros, ponchos, and serapes of the type worn by Don Carlos's vaqueros, the garb of the Rancho Pistoleros, not the uniforms worn by the Opera House guards. The sombreros were worn with brims pulled low in front, partially covering their faces. The waiters wore short black jackets, white shirts, and black pants. They were bareheaded, faces in plain view. Juan Garza and Howlin' Jeff Howell.
They belong to us, Hector.
Hector opened the other double door wide.
Come in, men.
Garza and Howell entered first, one pulling and the other pushing the four-wheeled serving cart through the doorway. Its table-like upper surface held open crates of sparkling wine, set atop a white linen tablecloth whose sides fell almost to the tops of the wheels, screening the underside of the cart. The three guards followed in their wake. Sam and Hector closed the doors, Sam delaying long enough for a quick scan of the grounds outside. The sun had set, the sky was darkening, though some afterglow was still showing. He saw some guards keeping watch on the area some distance away from them. The back doors were closed, but not locked. The three guards that followed Juan and Jeff in took off their hats, ponchos, and serapes, revealing themselves as Matt Bodine, Johnny Ringo, and Polk Muldoon.
How goes it, brother?
Better now that I see you.
Howl and Garza each took hold of a rope handle at opposite ends of a wine crate. They hefted it off the top of the cart and set it down on the floor. Polk and Ringo did the same with the other wine crate. Jeff Howell gripped in both hands a bottom edge of the white linen tablecloth covering the cart. With the air of a stage magician performing a feat of sleight of hand, he whisked off the cloth, burying the underside of the cart. On the lower shelf stood the Montigny mitrailleuse machine gun, its stand and olive drab canvas pouches filled with cartridge plates full of ammunition.
For my next trick, I'm gonna make a bunch of slavers disappear.
See if you can make those guards along the back fence disappear first.
We already did. We took care of them before coming through the back gate. Those are our boys walking the wall. Curly Bill and Dutch Snyder and some of the others. The rest are inside too, waiting for the go.
Bill wanted to come in for the turkey shoot, but I convinced him it was more important for him to stay outside and cover our retreat with the girls.
The rebels had the serving cart and these waiters' outfits waiting for us, just like we planned. Me and Juan put them on, and here we are.
You have made a grave error, my friend.
Remy held up a wine bottle.
I did? What?
Sparkling wine must be served chilled. This is warm.
Why, you son of a... Yeah, that is you goddamn son of a gun, you.
Take a look at those appetizers, though.
Matt started taking wine bottles out of a crate and setting them down on the floor. Below the top layer of bottles were repeating rifles, six guns, and bandoliers of ammunition. Remy set the machine gun's tripod stand on top of the serving cart. Sam helped them haul the mitrailleuse out from under the cart, lifting it and lowering it so that its base support post was fitted into the socket at the top of the tripod stand. Ringo's twin ivory-handled Colts were holstered on his hips. He picked up a Winchester rifle and a couple of bandoliers from a wine crate, putting the bandoliers over his shoulders so they crisscrossed his torso, making an X. Matt hauled out a gun belt with a holstered gun, proffering it to Sam.
Your gun, hombre.
Much obliged.
Sam buckled on the gun belt and settled it down low on his hips the way he liked it.
Yours too, Remy.
Thank you, my friend.
Remy strapped on his gun, sticking the pistol he had in the top of his belt on the opposite hip. The others armed themselves with rifles and bandoliers. When they were done, there were still some extras left.
For you and your friends, amigo. Help yourself.
Gracias.
Hector quickly grabbed himself a Winchester. Remy started wheeling the cart with the mitrailleuse on top of the elevator lift platform directly under where center stage would be. The ammunition pouches lay on the bottom shelf. Juan and Jeff pitched in, lending a hand, rolling the heavy-laden cart onto the platform.
I'll make sure things are squared away with the guards.
Sam went into the hall, Ringo and Hector following. Herrera and friends had the situation in hand. The duennas had been rounded up at gunpoint and put into a small supply closet. Hector used a key from his ring to lock the door. Open doorways lining the hall were crowded with girls in white nightdresses looking out. Duenna Dulce's corpse lay on the floor where it had been struck down, nobody having bothered to move it.
Where's our girls?
They're all our girls now, John.
Point taken. The American girls, the one Jones took? Where are they?
There.
Sam indicated the room from which Duenna Dulce had emerged. Ringo went through the doorway.
I'm on your side, girls. We've come to take you home.
He's taking us home. Oh, we're going home. We're going home.
One of the girls in the room, Rowena Whitman, who came from a ranch in the Sulphur Springs Valley outside of Tombstone, stepped forward.
This is Johnny Ringo.
At your service.
Ringo touched the tip of his hat brim between thumb and forefinger.
Hush up, y'all. We're not out of the woods yet, not by a long shot.
You're going to have to cooperate and do as you're told to make this thing work, girls. A bunch of us came from Tombstone to bring you home. Sorry I couldn't identify myself when I came through here yesterday and let you know what was in the works, but we couldn't risk tipping our hand to the slavers. Is this all of you? Are others of you being kept elsewhere?
No, we're all here.
We've got wagons waiting out back for you, but we can't move you just yet. Some of us are going to stage a diversion to distract the slavers and keep them busy while we move you out. Quiet down, sit tight, and one of us will be along in a minute or two to tell you what's next.
Keep up your courage, gals. Don't lose your nerve, and you'll be on your way home real soon now.
Oh, thank you, Johnny.
Sam nodded to Ringo, who followed him into the hall. Matt Bodine stuck his head through the doorway of the understage area into the hall, looking around. He saw Sam and Ringo and motioned to them.
We're loaded up and ready to go, but we need a couple of hands to work the lift.
We need Miguel and Vicente at the capstan, Pepe. You and La Vieja will have to hold the girls back until we get the ball rolling.
How will I know when to start moving them out?
Wait till we come back down. We can cover their flight then. That's the safest way, if safe is a word that applies to a tight spot like this. When the shooting starts, get them going.
It shall be as you say, amigo. Good luck.
To you too.
Sam and stagehands Vicente and Miguel went through the doorway. Remy, Matt, and Jeff Howell stood on the lift platform with Polk, Juan Garza, and Crew Chief Hector at the capstan. Ringo, rifle in hand, stood on the spiral staircase at the left wall of the space, about halfway to the top. The capstan, a wooden cylinder 4 feet tall and 3 feet in diameter, stood mounted on a sturdy, square-shaped platform bolted to the floor. The platform was open at the sides, making visible the rims of tooth-geared wooden wheels and rods like giant clockwork innards stacked vertically beneath. Chains ran from the gearwork to a set of wheels and pulleys and a block-and-tackle arrangement mounted on the left wall, controlling cable-like rope hawsers that ran up the wall and across the ceiling before dropping straight down to the sides of the rectangular lift platform below. At the top of the capstan, a number of wooden spokes jutted out horizontally from the hub, allowing the central shaft to rotate on its axis, turning the gears below and manipulating chains and ropes to raise or lower the platform as needed. The block and tackle rigging enabled a few stagehands to work the platform. Manuel and Vicente took their places at the capstan, freeing Hector.
Two of our men are on stage behind the curtain, keeping an eye on things. I will tell them that the time has come for the axe to fall. A time we have been waiting for so long, fearing it might never arrive.
Hector crossed to the spiral staircase along the right-hand wall, starting up it, rifle in hand, six gun in his belt. Ringo paused, waiting for Hector to ascend and pass the word to his fellow rebels. A moment later, he started up the spiral staircase with its wooden treads and iron risers and struts, corkscrewing around a vertical central iron shaft. The backstage area was lit, but not brightly. The curtains were closed, screening the stage from the audience on the other side. On the side of the stage opposite from Ringo, Hector stood, animatedly talking to another stagehand. A third stood at center stage where the curtains joined, peeking out through a narrow slit between them to keep watch on the comings and goings in the theater hall, ready to sound the alarm should any show sign of coming back behind the curtain. Seeing Ringo, Hector pointed him out to the stagehand to whom he'd been talking. Ringo raised a hand in greeting, the stagehand nodding. Urged by Hector, the stagehand started down the staircase, disappearing through the hole in the floor. Descending to the understage floor, he crossed to take his place at the capstan. He, Juan Garza, Polk Muldoon, Vicente, and Miguel stood in the spaces between the capstan handles, each facing the back of the next man before him in his slot, each gripping one of the horizontal spokes in both hands. La Vieja stood in the understage doorway, holding back the girls crowding the halls. Pepe Herrera stood beside the wall, gripping the wooden handle of the lever controlling the trapdoor mechanism. Matt, Sam, Remy, and Jeff were aboard the lift platform. Matt and Remy sat cross-legged on the platform Indian style, the machine gun between them. Each held the cart to steady it. Sam and Jeff stood at opposite ends of the lift, gripping the twin vertical hawsers rising to pulley wheels set in the floor beside the short ends of the trapdoor hatch. Remy consulted his pocket watch.
8 o'clock. Showtime.
Herrera threw the switch. Above, the seemingly solid ceiling parted, hinged hatches swinging open to fall vertically in place, opening a rectangular space in the stage floor. The men put their weight against the handles, digging in, moving forward, pushing the spoke handles gripped in front of them. The platform left the floor, rising ceilingward. It rushed upward through the space, swiftly rising up to and through the trapdoor hatchway. It fit neatly in the oblong space, its topside level with the stage floor, with only a hairline crack around the edges to indicate the platform's outline. Matt, Sam, Remy, and Jeff, and the mitrailleuse-bearing cart appeared on stage, materializing as if by magic. Handles on the legs of the cart allowed the wheels to lock in place, freezing them and immobilizing the cart. Remy readied the mitrailleuse, ramming a cartridge plate into the receiver at the underside of the piece, hitting it with his palm to ensure it was properly lodged. Matt stood beside him, carefully studying Remy's actions, fascinated by the gun, absorbed in its workings. Remy pulled the bolt forward, then pushed it back, engaging the firing mechanism. Matt and Jeff flanked the machine gun cart on one side, Sam and Ringo on the other. Hector and a second stagehand waited in the wings, manning the ropes controlling the opening and closing of the curtains.
Ready.
Matt waved a hand, signaling the stagehands. He shouldered his rifle, as did Sam, Ringo, and Jeff. Curtains parted in the center, the opening space widening as twin sets of red velvet curtains rushed away from each other to the sides, bearing the stage. It didn't take the audience long to realize something was wrong. Before any of them had a chance to do anything other than look confused, Remy opened up with the mitrailleuse, the others cutting loose with their rifles. Remy went for the guards first. They were a sweet target ranged along the side and rear walls of the theater. Most were on the rear wall, so he targeted them first, swinging the machine gun on its tripod, sweeping the muzzle from left to right. The four riflemen were no less enthusiastic, picking off the guards along the sidewall. A lull opened in the clamor as Remy exhausted his cartridge plate, pausing to reload. A couple of pistoleros standing in the aisle near the stage swung their six guns toward the machine gunner to take him out. Matt Bodine swung his rifle into play. They crumpled to the floor. By the time that was done, Remy had reloaded another cartridge plate. Panicked fugitives fled blindly in all directions at once like so many chickens with their heads cut off, tripping each other up. As Sam was shooting, a figure jumped up from where he'd been crouching behind the seats, darting into the aisle and running madly toward the back of the hall. He saw that it was Sebastiano. Sam had been looking for him. Sebastiano ran with arms and legs pumping, sprinting on his toes, fast eating up the distance between himself and escape. Sam took careful aim at one of his legs. Sebastiano fell, sprawling. A fat old bawd overstuffed in a too-tight green satin gown and her two bodyguards came hurrying up the aisle. Sebastiano was in the way, so they ran him down, trampling him underfoot. Sam paused, holding his fire for a few beats. The hefty madam and her two protectors ran on, leaving Sebastiano sprawled in the carpeted aisle, twitching and jerking. Clutching the arm of an aisle seat, he began trying to pull himself up. Sebastiano somehow hauled himself forward and began crawling up the aisle, pulling himself from seat to seat, dragging himself along with one dead leg trailing behind him. Sam shot him in the arm that was pulling him along. Sebastiano went down again and lay there writhing and squirming. Matt saw that some fires were started. He assumed by some of the men shooting at the candle chandeliers above. A number of small, independent fires had combined into one furious conflagration, smoke columns rising from it. The theater was filling with heat and smoke. Matt Bodine reckoned that he and his fellow revengers had done their part here. He motioned for the others to stand down and begin the retreat. Hector and his fellow stagehand had already gone below to the understage area. Matt and Sam stood side by side, laying down covering fire while the others got back to the platform. Ringo stood in the open hatchway of the spiral staircase, waiting for the others to step onto it. When they were all in place, he leaned over the rail.
Take it down!
The lift platform started downward, sinking through the oblong hatchway. Matt, Remy, Sam, and Jeff sat on the platform to better maintain their balance during the descent. Herrera once more worked the lever, closing the trapdoors and sealing them shut. No enemy gunman could shoot down through the hatchway at them. The understage rear doors were open, Pima Joe and Ed Dane standing beside them. Gunfire could be heard throughout the Opera House grounds. Sam went to the rear doors, approaching them from the side so as not to outline himself in the gaping doorway.
Sounded like hell's a-popping up there, Sam.
I said we'd bring down the house.
Well, sure, but what do you do for an encore?
Get the girls out of here.
A lot of folks have the same idea.
Ed Dane gestured toward the open doorway, which framed a group of people gathering outside. A mixed bunch of townsfolk and campesinos were collecting there, with more coming every minute.
They're waiting to take their gals home, too.
We won't disappoint them.